Hey there, veterans. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. There are a ton of resources out there for veterans, and I'm learning about more of them each and every day. That's why I've added a directory on my website to help you find the resources that are right for you. If you go to beyondtheuniform.io/directory, you can see these resources and you can add to them. Hope this helps and enjoy the show.
Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 66 with Sean Barney.
Well, I think many of us serve because we love this country, we love what it stands for, and I think like many people, I'm frustrated that right now our representatives are not as good as the country they represent. They've allowed the American dream to fade, they've allowed money to get a dominant influence over our politics, they've failed to address some of the defining challenges of our time, like climate change, and I just think our democracy is our inheritance as citizens we deserve better. And I think veterans have that love of country that can motivate us to run into the breach in that regard. And I think we have a lot to offer.
The top three reasons to listen to today's episode are, number one, Purple Heart. Sean shares the story of his life-threatening injury in Iraq and how this affected his thoughts on career and life. Number two, public service. Sean recently ran in an extremely close race for Congress in Delaware. His motivation for seeking office is inspirational and one that would benefit any listener. Number three, openness. Sean was one of the first veterans, if not the first, to openly talk about his PTSD on the campaign trail. He talks about how this was motivated out of an obligation to help other veterans, and I found it very inspiring. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, there are other episodes, show notes, a directory of resources, and more. And with that, let's dive in to my interview with Sean Barney. Joining me today in Wilmington, Delaware is Sean Barney. Sean, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you, Justin. It's wonderful to be with you.
So for listeners, I wanted to give just a very brief background for Sean. Sean is a public defender. He started out at Swarthmore College, after which he served for 5 years as a machine gunner in the 25th Marine Regiment, where he was awarded the Purple Heart. Since transitioning from the Marines, Sean has worked at the think tank Third Way. He has also been extremely active in politics, one of the main things we'll talk about today. His experience here is extensive, but a few highlights are serving as both the campaign manager and then policy director for Governor Jack Merkel and a candidate for Congress. Sean holds a Master's of Arts from Columbia University, a Master's of Public Administration from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and a Juris Doctor from Yale Law School. So, Sean, usually I start out asking about post-military life, but I was wondering if you'd be open to sharing a little bit of the story behind your Purple Heart.
Sure. Our regiment was deployed to Fallujah in 2006 after the city had been retaken a second time. And our commanders became frustrated not too long after we got there, pretty early in our deployment, became frustrated that we were subject to a lot of hit-and-run attacks. We were being sniped at, attacked, and not often having an opportunity for sort of a toe-to-toe fight in response. And I think our commanders felt very confident that if we could get a toe-to-toe fight, that that would be to our advantage. So about a week before I ended up being hit, our commanders had first sort of experimented with setting up a cordon with vehicles, making as if we were cordoning off an ID and just sitting, waiting for the attack that we were sure would come, but with overwatch in place and prepared to respond. And that encounter went very well from our commander's perspective. And so we sort of up the ante about a week later. We went in on vehicles to one of the neighborhoods in Fallujah. Many veterans will be familiar with it, the Pizza Slice, and sort of stirred things up in vehicles with loudspeakers, messages about how the insurgents were unwilling to come out and fight toe-to-toe with the Marines. We then returned to our compound at the CMOC in Fallujah and dismounted and went back out to the area on foot. And once again, made as if we were cordoning off an IED, this time on foot, having inserted Overwatch overnight, and waited for the attack to develop. And in this case, the beginning of the engagement went as we had hoped, but at some point we had very active snipers on the other side in Fallujah at that time, and in the course of the engagement, there was a sniper that ended up getting me in his sights, ended up hitting me right just under the Adam's apple. I ended up being just tremendously fortunate. The bullet missed my windpipe, missed my spine, despite going in just under the Adam's apple. I did end up having some nerve damage, but just got overall very, 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 very fortunate, and was most of all fortunate to be serving with the Marines that I was serving with, the Navy corpsmen that I was serving with, who were just absolute heroes that day, and really against all odds. I mean, they just sort of blew the minds of my doctors back at Bethesda when they saw what had happened, and the fact that those I was serving with managed to help me get out of there alive.
Man, that's just so incredible. I've never actually met on the show or just outside of the show anyone who was awarded the Purple Heart, and just can't imagine that experience. I'm wondering how did that impact your view on life? I can't imagine going through that and just how close you were to things being so much worse. What was the impact from that?
Well, it certainly gives you great perspective. I mean, I wake up every day knowing that I very nearly wasn't, or very nearly am not here day to day. In many cases, the odds are shouldn't be. When I came to at the hospital at Bethesda, the doctors that greeted me said part of it was the technology and the way the military had learned and gotten better at handling casualties, such that I wouldn't have been saved at the beginning of the Iraq War. That is learning that had happened just in the early years of that war that enabled them to save somebody like me. So I think it certainly does give you perspective that you treat every day as a gift and as an opportunity, but it's also a charge because, for example, one of my best friends in the Marine Corps ended up being KIA in Fallujah. He was shot in the abdomen just under the plate. And if you think between the two of us, if you had to choose where you'd be shot, in the abdomen, below the plate or through the neck, you would probably choose the abdomen. And it's part of the reality of war that there's so much that's out of your control, and it's a very sobering thing to recognize that and understanding that. And so to realize that there are others who were remarkable Marines, sailors, soldiers who just weren't as lucky as I happened to get that day is a charge to make sure that every day you're carrying on in the tradition and making it count in terms of your opportunity to live in this country that we all loved and served.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. You know, I feel that sense of gratitude from you, and I also feel that sense of purpose. And I admire that sense that how you've taken that and turned that into a considerable drive and a tribute to their memory of recognizing it could have been you very easily. And I was curious about the point at which you decided to leave the Marine Corps and how you approached that decision.
Well, that ended up being pretty well decided for me. I did end up having nerve damage. The bullet, while it missed my spine, thankfully hit. It did, unfortunately, hit some nerves coming off the spine. So when I first got back, my right arm was completely paralyzed. I did have a surgery that gave me back some function in my right arm, but not such that I could continue as the infantry Marine that I was and that I had signed up to be. And so I ended up being medically retired. And that was something that you know, yeah, I had a lot of conflicted thoughts about because I'd signed up after 9/11. I think all of us who have served know the feeling of being part of a team and wanting to be with those who are part of that team when they're doing their work and when they're particularly when they're in harm's way. I remember when I came to in the hospital in Bethesda, almost immediately I felt guilty at being in a comfortable bed in the United States and knowing that my platoon mates were out on patrol and out on post and out on raids. And I think that never quite leaves you. And so the decision to leave the service, knowing that you will never be part of that that effort again, is not easy. But it was the right thing under the circumstances for me because I would have been in the condition that I was in more of a liability to any of my fellow Marines than otherwise.
Man, I'm just imagining not only the uncertainty physically about this dramatic change in your life, but then also unexpectedly having this transition before you. I just imagine that really impacts your view of identity in that moment. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for other veterans who may be in a similar circumstance of facing that transition earlier than they expected and having to reevaluate all of that. Like, what helped you get through?
Well, I had about a year of surgeries and physical therapy. And then once I did that, I made the decision that I was at sort of a pause point in life. Very often in life, we're in the midst of whatever it is we're doing or the next logical thing. And there's not many times in life where you're just sort of at a pause point and can seemingly go in one of many directions. And so for me, it made logical sense, particularly with the benefits that we have as veterans. It made sense to go back to school. And that's when I did go back to school at that time. And I would suggest to any veteran who's transitioning out to give serious thought about using those benefits to go back to school, because not only is education so valuable and that opportunity to use that time to train up so valuable, but it's also a good time to have that time for a few years in school where you can really be out of the military and yet not yet needing to immediately commit to the next sort of long-term thing, but you can use the time to think about exactly what you want to do. So I think that's always worth thinking about, given that we as veterans often have that opportunity. I think the other thing I'd just say is make sure, and this is partly the public policy person in me, but it's also out of public experience, is get in contact with the VA right away. You may not feel like you have immediate needs, but it's when something comes up, whether it is health-related, whether it's related to your service and something that comes up later, or whether it's simply issues of some of the benefits that are out there. You get married, you want to buy a house. It's just very valuable to have that pre-existing relationship. And as somebody who is on the public policy side, looked a lot into some of the issues around veteran suicide and post-traumatic stress disorder, TBI, too often the people who end up that we end up losing have not been in contact with the VA. They have clear needs, and they just have never made that connection and relationship with the VA. And so I'd encourage veterans right away, because once you're past that immediate transition point, it can be a little daunting to approach the VA as bureaucratic as it can feel, particularly from the outside.
You know, there's so much I wanted to learn about your background, and I know we'll kind of backtrack and get there, but I wonder if we could start with your recent experience in this hard-fought Democratic primary for Congress in Delaware. How did you first decide to run for office?
Well, I think many of us serve because we love this country, we love what it stands for, we love what in its history it's accomplished. And I think like many people, not just veterans, but like many people, I'm frustrated that right now our representatives are not at least in my view, as good as the country they represent. They've allowed the American dream to fade. They've allowed money to get a dominant influence over our politics. They've failed to address some of the defining challenges of our time, like climate change. Often these days, they struggle to even pass an annual budget. And I just think our democracy is our inheritance as citizens, and as citizens, we deserve better. And I think veterans have that love of country that can motivate us to sort of run into the breach in that regard. And I think we have a lot to offer on that front. And so that's where it started with me. And then with some of the organizations out there, like New Politics, like Vote Vets, and encourage veterans to get involved. As you talk with people involved with those organizations, it makes even more sense. And that goes to a larger point, is that I think it's important for us as veterans to find ways to serve and continue to serve, because it becomes so important to who we are. And that doesn't mean it has to be in politics. It can be in a lot of different ways. But I think if you look at organizations like Team Rubicon, I think they're on to something, in that not only do we have a lot to offer the country, but we are truest to ourselves, and we'll find the greatest satisfaction, given who we have become through service, if we find a way to continue to be involved in service.
It's so energizing to hear you say that. I mean, I just know, with your background and with many of veterans' backgrounds, that integrity and that discipline and that just initial dedication that caused them to sign up, you know, to be willing to risk their lives for their country. I just think it's so noble to continue that pursuit of giving back to the country, giving back to this country. And I think that, you know, I would love to see more people like you in politics. And I wanted, you mentioned them already, so I'll jump ahead, but I was wondering if you could share more about New Politics, and I'll be having Emily, their founder, on the show in a couple of weeks, but I'm wondering if you could talk more about New Politics and how they helped you along the way when you were running for office.
Sure, and Emily's just great. She has a theory of change in response to a lot of what I was talking about the ways in which I'm disappointed. I think many of us are disappointed with our current political leadership. Is her theory of change is, if you want to have a politics that's responsive to the public good, then you need to have people who have shown a demonstrated commitment to serve, are not simply in it for some of the other reasons that people may run for office of ego or power, or, you know, but have shown in what they've done in the past that they have a demonstrated commitment to serving others and ideas greater than themselves, ahead of themselves. And for her, it's not just military veterans, it's service veterans of all kinds of service, the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, other service opportunities and experience. And she's also bipartisan. She works with Republicans, with Democrats, and she assists people who have that service experience in their background, want to continue to go on and serve, and in her case, want to do it specifically in the political realm and put themselves forward for elective office. And she's fantastic. The organization is fantastic. They really just are soup to nuts, help you navigate the process from the very beginning, because most service veterans don't really know what the decision even means to run for office, in terms of putting together a team, in terms of what you're going to have to be able to accomplish in terms of fundraising. So from day to one, she just is there as a resource to talk with you about, you know, what this is going to look like, what your life is going to look like as a candidate, and to help you connect you with talent for your team. And all throughout provides all sorts of different kinds of support, including moral support. I mean, one thing that is not obvious from the outside when you look at a campaign or somebody running is it can be a very lonely experience to run, because it's ultimately your individual name that's on the ballot. You're being criticized left and right. Everybody's second-guessing what you're doing. And there's a lot of uncertainty as you're going through the campaign. Nobody knows how it's going to turn out, all the while you're doing a lot of work. And so to have somebody there who, because of what her organization's mission is believes so deeply in what you're doing and reinforces that every day is something that can mean a great deal to you individually as a candidate when you're going through the process.
That's incredible. And I just love that she's, it sounds like she's working on both sides of the aisle, and it's more of she's fixated on someone's background and how that makes them a good candidate for future public service. And it doesn't matter in what capacity, just wanting to help them along. And I'm curious, because you know, you had said that when you first got into this, that you know, that you and most people don't understand what life is like in the campaign. I share that. I have no idea. And I was curious if you could, for our listeners, paint that picture of what was life like while you were running, like, and how long was that process?
So I ended up entering the race in December of 2015 for a September 2016 primary. So I guess about 10 months of active campaigning. I had been talking with Emily and starting to work on putting together an organization in the couple months before that. So so overall about a year. And in many cases, it can be longer than that. As many candidates, the earlier you can start, actually, the better. And so many candidates will be at it for up to 2 years before an election. And one of the reasons that you want to get off to an early start is the reality that shapes so much of your experience as a candidate. In our politics today, money is so important. And particularly for somebody who's running as a non-incumbent, who doesn't hold office already, as most of the people she's trying to get into politics are going to be, it's going to be very hard work because politicians who hold office, there are a lot of people who want to attend their fundraisers and donate to their campaigns because of who they are and the power they already have. When you are not in office and running, particularly for the first time, there aren't a lot of those people. And you really got to turn around to friends, to family, to colleagues, to people from all sorts of circles that you've known throughout your life. And it's one of my pieces of advice to anybody who might be interested in running. I very much encourage people to do so. We need good people to run, and I think veterans, we need more veterans to run. But as a practical matter, if it's something you're thinking about doing, one of the most important things you can do before you make a decision is sit down and literally start to make a list and be very specific about names and say, who exactly do I think I'm going to get this money from? Who am I going to ask? How much am I going to ask of them? And gauge your comfort level in doing that, because the very beginning, the sort of seed money, if you will, almost always has come from the people closest to you, family, close friends, and you want to be realistic with yourself about, Do I want to wake up each day and have the main thing I need to do that day be to pick up the phone and make that kind of ask of people? Because that's an enormous part of it, for better or for worse. And I tend to think for worse in terms of the state of our politics and in terms of the fundraising that officials have to do once they get there, as opposed to doing their job. But that is the reality. And since we're mission-oriented people as veterans, we need to be realistic about what getting the mission done entails.
I wanted to ask more about that with finances. And what strikes me as you say that is that on so many of these interviews, a common theme that has emerged is the difficulty that most veterans have, especially when they first get out, of asking for help, of asking for intros, of asking for an interview, of asking for advice. And it seems to go contrary to a lot of the ideals that were instilled in us in our time in the military. And, you know, if that's asking for an introduction, I can only imagine how much more it is than to be asking people for money. And I'm wondering, what was it like raising money for office?
Well, I think this is something that Emily can probably speak very well to when you have a chance to talk with her, since she works with so many veterans. But I know she's, in my workings with her, she's commented on this to me too. And I think it is especially acute for military veterans because we're attuned not only to wanting to serve and help people rather than ask things of people, but we're also deeply influenced by the ideal that we should be pulling our own weight. I mean, we don't culturally within our units want to be the person who's asking for things, asking for help. We want to be the person who's picking up somebody else's rucksack, right? So I think it absolutely is true that one of the toughest things for veterans getting into politics is making that transition where you're asking so much. And it is a paradox because you're running because you want to go do the job, which is about helping people and serving the country. But to get there, you have to go through this phase that is intensely driven by asks for money, for volunteers, for help, and in all sorts of ways. And I think the biggest thing in terms of getting through it, doing it well, is just really, really believing in what you're doing. And if you believe in what you're doing, if you believe in the difference that you're trying to make for the country, then it becomes less about asking for something for yourself, and it becomes more about getting on the phone, having conversations with people about what it is that you're trying to accomplish, and seeking their buy-in and seeking their support. And over time, if you look at it that way, and if you do believe strongly in what you're doing, then I believe that the veterans could be really, really successful at it.
Yeah, it strikes me with what one thing that's helped me with, you know, this is so different, but with sales of selling software to companies, of someone had told me like, hey, if you really believe that you can help someone, then like selling, it takes on a new form, which is like being excited that I can actually add value for this person. I can actually make their life easier, which is a very different view than, you know, I think normally I or most people approach this as like, you feel like you're bothering people or in some way inflicting discomfort on them. And what I love about what you're saying is that like, you know, and I don't know you well, but from everything you've said so far, I believe that you could do such a good job in political office. And it's like, man, if you believe that, then when you're asking for this money, it's because you know you can help. It's money that you know can make a difference in our country and in millions of lives. And so I like the way that you explain that, of just kind of shifting perspective on this fundraising process.
Absolutely. And I think where you look at Emily's theory of change, it's something that people can get excited about. And I think where veterans should feel confidence that what they're offering, it, particularly in politics, particularly in public service, is something that people have a great hunger for. I mean, people want leaders who are going to put the public good first, who are willing to make sacrifices for the public good, who are willing to take risks to do the right thing. And they know that as veterans, we're all about that. They know that we have a track record of doing that. And so if a veteran chooses to get involved in this arena, they should always keep that in mind, because you will find that when you reach out and tell people what you're trying to do, more often than not, and more often than you might expect going in, you're going to find that you have people that are very excited and are more than happy to help in whatever way they can. And for a certain group of people, the best way they can help you and that they can find to help you is to contribute.
And Eric, our mutual friend who introduced me, he was saying, I believe that you were either the first or amongst the first veterans to talk about PTSD on the campaign trail. Could you share more about this and what that was like?
Sure. So I had not talked publicly before I was a candidate about the fact that I'd been diagnosed with PTSD after I returned. And it was actually an issue that we touched upon earlier that influenced me to speak out, which is I learned actually from Patrick Murphy, the former congressman from Pennsylvania, the first Iraq War veteran elected to Congress. He told me, he cited a figure to me about how the great majority of those veterans that we are losing to suicide are not in contact with the VA. And so while they have need and while they could be helped, they're simply not getting it, and they're falling through the cracks. And I spoke with him. I spoke with Zach Iskel, who runs the Headstrong Project, and has raised a lot of money to get treatment to veterans with PTSD, with TBI. And when we talked privately and he learned of my experience, he just said very directly to me, you have an obligation to let people know, because too many veterans aren't coming forward and seeking the help that they need. And I was fortunate because my symptoms were just manifest in the hospital when I was in Bethesda. And so it was never a question of it not being discovered or my falling through the cracks. It was just a basic fact of my recovery when I got out. And when I transitioned from the military to the VA, it was part of my records. And so I got the treatment that I needed, and I'm well today because I did. And that was part of Zach Iskel's point, too, is that it's so important that the public, that veterans understand that this is very treatable. And so, you know, Zach said to me, you're running for Congress. You're somebody who has gone through PTSD and you're running for Congress. People need to know that if they're in a dark spot or they're struggling right now, they need to know that this is a treatable thing, and you can go on and do wonderful things and contribute greatly. And so that was ultimately the what persuaded me. And I'm very glad I did. I mean, the day after I went public, I started receiving telephone calls from veterans around the country who hadn't known me before. I didn't know them, just reaching out to say thank you. And if any of us sharing our story encourages one person to come forward and get help that they need, then it's well worth it. We have lost two members of platoon mates of mine since I've returned to Iraq to PTSD, to suicide. And those are both instances where they were people who had clear signs, but they were not involved with the VA, and they just simply didn't get the help that they needed and they deserved.
I love that sense of the obligation to take action publicly. And I just can imagine that, you know, that the night that you come forward on this, there must have been a lot of, I mean, it's such a personal and private thing to have to share publicly, but I can imagine there must have been this moment of like, how is this going to affect things, and wondering if it was going to adversely affect the campaign. Was there that kind of sense of fear that maybe this would be used against you in some way or hurt your campaign?
There was some great concern on the part of some of the members of our team, some who felt very strongly that it would have a negative impact and negative influence. And I just thought it was an important thing that we talk about for the reasons that we just discussed, and that ultimately, when it's very clearly the right thing to do, and it very clearly could make a difference in people's lives, then it's simply the right thing to do. And maybe it hurts you, maybe it doesn't. Either way, if you want to serve, you want to be in a position where you're getting elected because you're doing what you think is right.
I think that's such a great role model. I think that's just a really incredible example to set forward. I would love to learn about what day-to-day life was like on the trail and how you managed your campaign. And I know that every day must have been very different, but if you could just kind of paint that picture of what one day on the trail looked like, I think it'd be really interesting.
Well, I was very fortunate to have just an incredible team that came to the table to work on this campaign. We had Danny Franklin and PG and Greco, who helped President Obama get elected and reelected, came and worked on this campaign. And PG and Greco has done work for veterans, does work on Tammy Duckworth's campaigns, worked for Patrick Murphy back when he was a congressman. We had Joe Trippi working on the campaign, who'd revolutionized politics as campaign manager for Howard Dean's presidential campaign. And has also done just some fantastic work with veterans, with Seth Moulton, with Tulsi Gabbard. I was very fortunate to have on the fundraising front, as important as that is, someone who had fundraised for Seth Moulton, Congressman Seth Moulton, Marine veteran, Iraq War veteran, and to have as my campaign manager someone who was not only a personal friend but who had worked for Patrick Murphy. So it was just a tremendous group of people, and it was very, very fortunate in that regard. And the other aspect, I mean, it touches on a subject that we've already touched on, but your major responsibility as a candidate is the fundraising. So a lot of the rest of it is responding to what's coming to you in terms of recommendations from your team. And a lot of your hours of the day, whether it's phone calls, whether it's meetings, are centered around fundraising. Although there is, it's an interesting, you've got to be able to move from meeting to meeting and do very different things. I've told people at times that campaigning for office is a little like a decathlon. There's about 10 different events that you compete in, if you will. I mean, there's the fundraising, and then there's interviews and media, and then there's, you know, retail politicking and talking with people, and then there's the policy, and then there's the management of it. So there's a lot of different things in that. It can be very, very satisfying, but it does end up being long hours, because really your waking hours, when anybody is willing to pick up a phone, is devoted to fundraising, and then it's in all those extra hours where everybody else in the world is on downtime that you know, run through policy and figure out what positions you're going to take on the issues when you go over op-eds and speeches and review material and things like that. So, but it's an exciting thing, although definitely on the fundraising front, it can be a grind.
What was the most challenging or difficult moment in the campaign? I just can't imagine for doing this for 9 or 10 months, let alone for the 2 years that others do it. But what was one of the more challenging moments?
For us, on my campaign, for myself and my team, we had one specific moment that was probably the hardest of the campaign, and it came about a week and a half out from Election Day. Our opponent, the opponent who ultimately ran the election, we learned through the news media and through filings that candidate had written a check, personal check out of personal wealth, that basically made it clear that our hopes to communicate at parity were not going to be achieved. And that came literally days after we had learned, after the last fundraising deadline, that we had successfully outraised the field. We'd raised the most money, which had been something that had given us great sense of accomplishment and satisfaction, because it is such hard work, and it had been done and accomplished as a team. And so we were really riding high and feeling good about what we had done together. And then with one writing of a personal check, not only did we no longer have the most money to communicate, but it became clear that we weren't really going to be that close. And it also meant that we went almost overnight from a situation where it was going to be a very hard fight, but we had a fighting chance, to one where I think internally and realistically we knew that we had very little chance at that point. So that was just very hard as a member of a team, as a leader of a team, that it worked their hearts out, and all of us had worked our hearts out together to have something happen so sudden and so out of our control, and at a certain level, so seemingly unfair as much as it's a reality of our politics today, that if you have that ability to write large checks to your own campaign, if you have personal wealth, you have an advantage. When we came face to face with it, it was tough.
I'm wondering, how does that influence your view on running again? And if you don't mind me asking, do you plan to run again? And like, what have you learned from this experience that would influence how that next campaign would go?
I don't know at this point whether I'll run again. I still believe deeply in it and all the reasons that that I got into the race and that myself and my team worked so hard every day. I think one of the things you learn running is that that politics is very often about timing and about moments. It's about things like, is there somebody else in the race that can self-finance in that way? Something that we didn't know when we got in and only found out later. And it's about who you are as a candidate and what it represents and whether it speaks to what is on voters' minds at the moment. As a veteran, it's a very, very powerful identity for all sorts of reasons that we've talked about and all sorts of very good reasons. And it's so powerful that you'll find very quickly if you run for office when you're a candidate that it becomes almost all that anybody identifies you with or talks or thinks about when they think about you. And that can be really, really great depending on the year, the election. I think of, say, as someone who's a Democrat who ran as a Democrat, I think of the year 2006 when there was a lot of concern about the direction of the Iraq war, and a lot of the Democrats took control of Congress in a wave that year, and a lot of it was about a lot of the politics, a lot of the debates, discussion in public affairs that year was about the Iraq war, and I can think of no better identity to have in politics at that moment that year than someone who knew what they were talking about because they've been there. Other years, it's not what's at the top of people's agenda. It's not their number one concern, and it can lead to a different outcome. And so I think in part what I've learned is that you do have to look carefully at how a race is shaping up, whether it's time. And you have to weigh that. You also have to weigh it against, I think, another important impulse, which is to get in there and put yourself forward and take a chance. I'm very proud of the fact that we did run. I'm glad that we put forward the vision we did, that we offered the voters in my state the choice that we offered them. And in my state of Delaware, there's a great example of how if you don't put the jersey on and get in the game, then you don't win. And that's our junior senator, Chris Coons, who ran in 2010, expecting to run against then Congressman Mike Castle for the Senate, who was a very popular congressman here. And that happened to be the Tea Party year. So Mike Castle got knocked off by Christine O'Donnell in a Republican primary. And suddenly the way was clear for Chris Coons, who nobody thought was going to win. It was suddenly a United States senator. So you need to measure and take a look at it, but you also need to, at a certain point, keep in mind that there's always risk involved. And if you've got a passion for it and something to say, then there's something to be said for putting the jersey on and getting in the game.
That's great. You mentioned a couple of resources already with New Politics and Vote Vets. I'm wondering for any veteran listening who's seeking a career in public service, what other resources, books, podcasts, programs, websites, would you recommend that they take a look at?
Well, I would just reiterate what I mentioned before, which is if you're thinking seriously about it, you get to that point where you're not only intrigued, but you're really thinking seriously about it, and you've sort of imagined what it would be like to be a candidate and you think you might like to do it, to really sit down and ask yourself that question of where is at least my first tranche of money going to come from, both so that you gauge how realistic it is that you can raise the kind of money that you need to be competitive, but also that will begin to it's the closest thing to actually picking up the phone and making those calls, to actually write it down on paper with specific names, to get you really thinking about what it means to make those asks, and whether you're comfortable doing it, and whether you are ready to start doing it. And so I think that's the most practical thing that somebody can do if they're looking to run for office, is set some reasonably healthy fraction of the overall amount that they think they need to run to raise to be in competitive in the campaign, and actually, you know, start a list or a spreadsheet and try to probably double that. Although he also raised for close to 2 years, so it partly depends on the media market, and certainly depends on whether there's an incumbent in the race. Seth Moulton also had to raise significantly more because he was running against a sitting incumbent member of Congress. And whenever you've got an incumbent involved, the amounts that are going to be needed to be competitive are going to be higher, because the incumbents just have much more opportunity to raise money.
It's really incredible. I mean, to put in context, the thought of you raising $750,000 in 10 months. So with my company, I've raised just over $3 million in funding, most of that institutional investors. And all of that was people giving money, you know, maybe the initial people to help me, but everyone was looking for a financial return. Like, everyone was looking to make money. It was an investment. And for you, I mean, this is like, there's not a financial return on this. This is people contributing money to you. And I imagine that's many, many people, and it's less institutions than on the venture capital side of things. And these are people giving you a lot of money because they believe in you and your ability to influence change. And I just think that's astounding to raise that amount of money in that short amount of time. It's really incredible.
Well, like I said, we were very proud do it, and it's why the moment you asked about was the hardest for us, having managed to do that over 10 months, and then to realize that the competitive advantage, or at least parity that we were hoping to accomplish for ourselves through that, was not to be, was hard. But I'm tremendously proud of our team, because it was a real team effort, and people just worked very hard to do it, including just putting a lot of thought into who it is that I ought to be reaching out to, and who I ought to be picking up the phone and calling. And there was just a lot of hard work and good thought put into that by the members of our team that made that possible.
That's great. Well, I always like to make room at the very end just to ask any other final words of wisdom you'd want to pass on to the active duty members and veterans listening. It could be personal or professional, but what else would you want to share with them?
Well, I just want to reiterate the point earlier that I think it's really important for us as veterans is to find ways to continue to serve, and that doesn't have to be in politics. I hope that there are great veterans out there who will choose to take that route, because I think we need it, and we're in a particularly needy place as a country, if you will, on that front. We need great help in that area. But whatever it is, whether it's working with a nonprofit or whether it's finding a way to start a business that addresses an important need and allows you to day in and day out work on meeting important needs, then just finding that way to continue to serve, I think, is so important for us as veterans. And not only is it important for us, but I think it's important for our country, because I think the people that we all served with, we know how much they have to offer. And I think we'll be a better country if they're willing to step forward and give of themselves and continue to do so.
Well, Sean, I really appreciate your example for the veteran community and just the advice that you've shared with the Beyond the Uniform community today. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Surface, surface, surface.
Thanks for listening. As we wrap up, I wanted to share three quick but important announcements. First of all, if you haven't already, please sign up for my newsletter at beyondtheuniform.io.
Although I publish on LinkedIn and Facebook, I'll be starting to use the newsletter as my primary means to share new articles, episodes, and resources relevant to the veteran community. Second, I would love to hear from you. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a relationship where I do all of the talking. You can view me as your very own dedicated resource to help you and other veterans in your civilian career. Have feedback on what I can do differently? Let me know. Someone in particular you want me to track down for an interview? I'm all ears. Know of another way that I could help the veteran community? I'm dying to know. You can find me on LinkedIn, comment on any post at beyondtheuniform.io, email me at justin@beyondtheuniform.io, or if you're in the intel industry, I'm sure you can track me down in some super creepy way. However you do it, take me up on it. I thrive on feedback. Lastly, a quick plug for a few resources I think would benefit any veteran. American Corporate Partners and Service to School both provide free assistance to any veteran. American Corporate Partners pairs you with a mentor in your desired industry, and Service to Schools finds a mentor at a suitable undergrad or graduate school program to help you with your application. Check them out. As always, tons of great content and resources available at beyondtheuniform.io. I'm Justin Nasiri, and I'll be back soon with more great episodes.